Welcome to the Reason Podcast. I'm Catherine Mangie Ward, editor-in-chief of Reason, and I am joined today by Nancy Rommelman, the author of a new book called To the Bridge. Thanks, Nancy.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk today about your process on this book, both as a reporter and then as a writer. We're going to talk a little bit about the commercial experience of this book with your publisher, Little A, which is an Amazon imprint. Yep. Is that accurate to say?
Correct.
And then hopefully you'll give us a little bit of a sneak peek of what else you're working on. I know no one ever likes to be asked about the next book, but there are other things besides the next book.
Correct.
So first, maybe you could just tell our listeners, who are you? Why should we care about Nancy Rommelman?
Nancy Rommelman. I am a long-form journalist writing sort of stories for different publications where the story is sometimes reported a certain way. It never looks that way to me. And then I got to, like most journalists, go find out what happened, what really happened. This book, it was May 23rd, 2009. A woman named Amanda Stott Smith went to the Selwood Bridge in Portland, Oregon at around 1:18 in the morning and dropped her two youngest children 90 feet into the Willamette River. Her four-year-old son, Eldon, died. Her seven-year-old daughter, Trinity, screamed and screamed and screamed until she was rescued 40 minutes later. Amanda was caught 9 hours later and eventually sentenced to 35 years in prison. I read about the story the day after it happened, and I just had to know how this happens because it's not what mothers do. I really committed probably about 2 days later to finding out what happened when the popular stories that the mob told were evil or crazy. And I did not think that answered the question or didn't answer it for me. So I went looking for how she found herself on the bridge that night.
So one thing you say in the book is not just that the stories were evil or crazy, but also we can never know.
That's right.
It's unknowable. And as a reader, at least, that felt to me like that was the thing that got your goat, maybe even more than the evil or crazy narrative. Obviously, you're a long-term journalist. Did it get your journalistic hackles up, or was it more existential than that?
I think it was both, but you're absolutely right, because the evil and crazy, that's the mob, right? They come in, you know, the day after, the week after, hang her from the Selwood Bridge, all this stuff, but then they go away. They've got the next story. When I was reading editorials in the Oregonian, say, you know, the sort of, you know, obviously very heartfelt editorials where they're saying, this is absolutely unfathomable. No one will ever understand how this happens. I just didn't believe that was true. And then when the judge, the sentencing judge, pronounced that to be the case, I thought, wow, we are just failing so badly here. And then Amanda's estranged husband also said it would never be understood. And my first thought was, yes, we are going to understand how this happens. And I think the reader that walks into the book thinking, there is no way this is going to make sense, I think by the end of the story, they're going to be able to say, you know, actually, you can understand how this happens. It's not that I'm going to tell you what to think, but I'm going to give you a lot of pieces that makes sense of it.
So one thing, as a reader of the book, you and I have talked about this a little bit. My middle name is Amanda, which is the name of the main character, the protagonist, I guess. Yeah. Anti-hero is probably even too glamorous. And my children are the same ages and genders as the two children in the book. And I've heard you say in other interviews that, you know, you ultimately don't have a sort of a part in your soul that says, like, well, I can see how you could throw your kids off a bridge. And yet people ask you about that a lot. They sort of say, like, well, is this a commentary on the broader condition of parenting or sort of the broader, like, plight of the mother? You know, how meta did you find yourself getting on that question? Like, do all parents want to chuck their kids off a bridge at some point?
Well, I have to say, I mean, I can speak for myself, and the answer is no. I've never had that feeling, nor, I mean, I've gotten angry with my child, I've been frustrated, but it has never occurred to me, nor would it ever occur to me. Now, you have people, and we've talked about this before, where they say a lot of mothers secretly in their dark nights of the soul can see doing something like this to their children. I read about it. I can't give you a number of people that do. Did you ever think this?
I don't think I have had that feeling, but I definitely have had the feeling of gee, this is harder than I thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine how someone with fewer resources, both sort of physical resources, right, like money, time, but also mental resources, you know, sanity and support, might go from, wow, this is harder than I thought it was going to be, to I have to make it stop.
I think, you know, most mothers were talking about, yeah, you're overburdened, you maybe you're working, you don't have enough money. I don't see these really as factors as moving you closer to doing something like this. I do see having your identity robbed piece by piece, losing your home, losing your custody of your children, losing your sense of self, and being sort of ritually humiliated until you feel like you don't have anything. Those are factors, I think, that will move a person closer to doing what Amanda did.
And that was what was essentially the background of right. this story, is what you found.
Right.
How did people close to the story greet your journalistic inquiry into it?
Oh, they were just overjoyed. No. No, there were no one would talk to me at all. The only people I was able to speak with initially was the mother of Eldon's best friend from preschool. She got in touch with me right away, because I was blogging at the time, and people wanted to talk about this story or talk to someone about it, and one of Amanda's friends. Otherwise, people were waiting for the trial. They were waiting for what Amanda's fate was going to be. And then when her fate was set, because she pled guilty so she wouldn't go up against the death penalty, then everybody wanted to talk to me, because they had information that they figured was going to come out at trial that sort of actually explained how maybe she got to this place. And now they weren't going to be able to either testify or see it in the news. So they came to me. Now, there were people in both families that would speak to me. One anonymously, I give her a pseudonym in the book, and then Amanda's grandmother, who needed to talk about it. No one in Amanda's family would talk about it, what their daughter had done. I mean, can you imagine this? This is like, it's more than an elephant in the room, but they just emotionally couldn't do it. But she needed to, and she plays an important role in the book and really leading me to a lot of things that I needed.
Then there's the other source of information, which is public records, mm-hmm. public officials. Talk about, A, your strategy, such as it was, for getting as much information as you could, and B, how kind of the keepers of official data received your interests.
So when you're investigating, you know, it's not always so easy to get records from the police. Are we allowed to curse on the Reason
podcast? We sure are. Okay, it's encouraged.
Okay, so as one editor said to me, he said, you know, the Portland police, their first five reactions when you're trying to get public records from them or the police reports are, fuck you. And then the sixth is, what the fuck do you want? And they never would give me what I needed, but I was able to get them anyway because I persisted and someone took pity on me and got me what I needed. I tried to get everything I could, but because it involved juveniles, it was kind of hard. Some health records, which of course were impossible to get, were accidentally released to a television station, and they gave me everything unbidden. They knew I was writing it. They just sent me the entire 150 pages. I was like, I love you.
Did you send them a fruit basket or something?
I gave him a thank you in the book. I really was able to get almost everything I needed. If you know how to do that, and of course, you know, maybe do things wrong the first couple of times, but I did get pretty much everything I needed in terms of the public records. And they were very important to sort of piece together, you know, timelines, and then eventually, you know, Amanda herself.
So one thing that, without sort of giving up all of the book's secrets, because I do think one of the pleasures of this book is coming along on the kind of path of discovery, which you take as a reporter. But sort of later in the book, the emphasis shifts partially to trying to understand Amanda's marriage to mm-hmm. to the father of her children, of the children who she throws off the bridge. I was sort of struck by the building of the timeline of the marriage out of public records, particularly the, you know,
right,
the times that the police right. or law enforcement right. was involved in the marriage. I found that felt somehow it that like the ability to build that timeline felt almost like more invasive into her life and their lives than the details of the murder. Like there's something about like, well, a murder is a murder, but like this is ordinary, everyday, disastrously bad marriage that crosses into the law enforcement realm. Did you have a sense of like, were there boundaries in where you wanted to go digging?
Well, so the records that we're talking about here are, you know, things released, you know, after a child is murdered in Oregon, within a year, the state is required to put out a CERT report, which is going to tell you everything that's happened. And because these were happening in different counties, they'd never been sort of amassed in one place before. So we could see 10 instances when there had been abuse or when, you know, someone had been called to the house or when Amanda was caught driving drunk, and we could see it all together. But if you think about it, that's like 10 instances in 12 years. I mean, it's bad. And then there were some earlier things when they were like brutalizing each other and, you know, throwing air conditioners at each other's head and all that. But if you're standing outside of that, if you're not those people, that stuff was easy to cover up. And nobody, I mean, people knew. I have had many people tell me it was the most disastrous marriage you'd ever seen. And yet they had the charm offensive, these two. And they could make things appear as though it wasn't their fault. It was always somebody else's fault. Or they would, you know, actually plan it to make it look like someone else's fault. So I don't know that anybody could have seen it clearly, or even just the objective observer saying, yeah, this is, there's disaster in the making, but there was.
Right. And I think, I mean, that's the other question that, you know, I thought about as I was reading the book, and I think sort of haunts the book, is how deterministic can we be about this sort of thing? Because as you say, lots of women are poor and desperate and mm-hmm. don't kill their children. Lots of women have bad divorces and don't kill their children. Lots of, you know, couples are dysfunctional, and lots of people lose their jobs, and lots of people get drunk and don't kill their children. But it's always tempting in hindsight to say, well, look at this pattern. It was clearly going to end in disaster. And I think that claim, this pattern shows it was going to end in disaster, often is used to justify intervention in people's lives, right? Like up to and including, well, should Child Protective Services have taken these kids away? How do you think about that question?
Well, so Amanda's estranged husband, or husband for this whole time, his name was Jason Smith. And I have been told by many, many, many people, and I've seen it myself in action, that he is just incredibly charming, incredibly bright. He's got a lot of money behind him. He was just a serial liar and a master manipulator. And I don't think we could have seen it coming because of that. But I do think that there was a very deliberate war waged so that he would always look good and she would always look bad. And at a certain point, she put up with that for a long time. She tried to fight it. She collapsed under it. And then at a certain point, she's like, this isn't going to happen anymore. And, you know, she fought him with the two things she had left.
Right. There's a sort of recurring motif during this cover-up period of like dinner parties that are always convened with high expectations. And there's like a nice wheel of brie and everyone's nicey nice. And it ends with like a water glass full of vodka and like the children eating Chinese food if they haven't been fed in a week.
Well, they haven't been. I mean, toward the end of the, I mean, there's a couple of dinner parties. It's nice to call them dinner parties.
Dinner parties.
It was sort of like the dinner disasters, you know, with, you know, him screaming at her and telling her the food tastes like shit and everybody has to sit at the table while she goes back in and cooks it again. And you're like, can you imagine this? You're sitting there. It's like, what do you do here? And there's children crying. And, but yeah, toward the end, she was drinking a great deal. And so there was no feeding of children. She was using all her energy at that point to figure out how to get her husband, who she was constantly locked in battle with, to come back home. And so the kids were really secondary at that point. So yeah, they didn't eat.
Let's back up into some of your other work for our listeners who are not familiar with it. In preparation for talking with you about this book and for reading the new book, I also read your previous book, which was a novel called The Bad Mother. And, you know, before that, or concurrent with that, you're a journalist who writes particularly kind of long form magazine-y type pieces that are really juicy. Talk about what your philosophy of picking a story to dig into looks like. I mean, this story itself, which you invested ultimately, I think we can start rounding it up to nearly a decade by the time you're done with book promotion.
Is
very striking on its own merits, but talk about when do you see a story and know this is the one I have to write about, or when do you see a story and say this is grist for my mill?
Well, as I started out saying at the beginning of the podcast, often it's where something looks like one thing and I'm like, it just doesn't really seem that way to me. And I've got to go and figure out why it doesn't seem that way for me. I've also made something of a cottage industry about writing about hoaxers and sociopaths. I interviewed John Wayne Gacy on death row before he was executed with a pen pal of his. We drove across the country to visit him and sort of took the sort of moral and cultural temperature of people going across the country, because Gacy was, it's a terrible word, but iconic. Everybody knew who he was. And it was interesting to like sit in the bar in Las Vegas or at the strip club or then go to the church in Oklahoma and kind of get everybody's intake on what they thought of this and why it was important to the culture. Some stories, you just see them and they just bite you. You're just like, I can't let this go. You're at your computer within 10 minutes. And then you're just invested until it's done. In terms of The Bad Mother, which is just a little tiny novel, I lived in Hollywood and I used to drive Hollywood Boulevard, twice a day, taking my daughter to and from school. And I just saw these kids, they're on the street. Everybody comes to Hollywood, either with a dream or out of desperation. And these kids are on the street. They're like, 14 and 15 years old. And I never interviewed one of them. It wasn't that I'd written a story for one of the LA papers and then thought, oh yeah, let me make a novel out of this. It was sort of osmosis, just soaking in their situations and their loneliness. And then I just sort of started to see these characters in my head. And I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I'd never written a novel. But I just sort of plunked it out and there they are.
In both of your books, I found myself having that, when you go to a horror movie and you're screaming at the screen, don't look behind you. Don't split up. I have this feeling in your writing. And I think, I have that feeling as a reader, and I feel like maybe you lack it or you have it in a different way. You do not radiate broadly judgment on what are just astonishingly bad decisions of both your fictional characters and then these real people. You're just straight up on the why. You're not on the what the fuck. And is that a fair characterization? Is that your experience of these characters as you are creating them? Because I'm just I had to put down the books a couple times because it was like, I cannot believe you are going to do that right now. But you are.
Well, okay, so now you're making me think about The Bad Mother. There definitely were a few people in this book, this one guy especially, where I'm writing him, I'm like, I don't like this guy, but I had to write it, but most of them I feel exceptionally tenderly toward. In terms of To the Bridge, you go in, first of all, you don't know. You're not predetermining your story. You don't know anything.
Yeah.
And as it moved on, there were certainly people that I was like, what? And sometimes I really didn't like these people. I mean, really didn't like. But at the same time, you got to let people tell you the story. And then you just put it together. So yeah, no judgment. But again, who put the story together? I put the story together and you're reading it and having that reaction. So maybe I'm just letting you have the reaction, but I didn't put it together. I also just love to write stories, especially from Los Angeles when I lived there. Stories that I would call like the good bruise. It's like it hurts, but you want to press on it. I once spent 6 months sitting in this old man bar down at SRO Hotel downtown and just sort of absorbing these people's lives. And that's my favorite kind of writing to do. It's just sit someplace and watch people and look at their sort of the way they've fooled themselves or the places they've found themselves and just, get that away.
So how do you get to do this? How is it that you can spend 6 months sitting in an old man bar soaking these things up?
And actually the old man bar was only a couple months. I did do a piece for the LA Weekly where I spent 6 months at a cop bar. And that was interesting. And they named it, you know, us versus them, because of course it was, but they let me hang around. But then, oh, my last day of reporting there, the Rampart scandal broke. And now I'm sitting inside the cop bar while they're variously like shouting at the television or hanging their heads. And that was interesting timing. How do I get
sketch,
to do it?
Sketch that scandal really quick for
okay, so the Rampart scandal was got back in the late 90s, early 2000s. So there was a Rampart division and what they were doing, they were like stealing drugs from the drug dealers and, you know, beating these people and disabling them. I mean, it was a bad, bad, bad unit, and they got busted. But of course, you know, there was Daryl Gates, and it was like, it was a mess. So that was interesting to be there for the first day of the scandal. How did I get to do this? I wrote for the LA Weekly for 15 years. And, you know, they had the time where they were like, if I would say to them, you know, I want to go spend 6 months at a bar, they're like, great, give me 9,000 words. And I was doing lots of other journalism and columns. And I wrote Jonathan Gold's column, may he rest in peace, when when he went to Gourmet. And they gave me a really long leash. And it was, you know, it was the best gig in the world. Now, those gigs are a little fewer now.
Yeah,
you know?
So we're sitting in New York right now talking the week of a 50% layoff at the New York Daily News. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the LA Weekly has had
a ghost ship, right?
A similar purge. Let's take a little detour for a second and talk about how hysterical should we be about the death of the local paper / alt weekly / dead tree newspaper, period.
Well, it's not going to get any better. I mean, how many papers do you have in New York now? I mean, do you count the Journal as being a New York paper? I guess it is. It's an international paper. You've got the Times and even the Times. I mean, look at how, you know, how they're contracting and, you know, they're dancing as fast as they can. I want to keep writing stories, and I know you want to keep running a magazine.
I would like to. That sounds good.
Yeah. And I would really like you to keep running that great, great magazine. But I have no idea, but it's not going to get any better. It'll just keep contracting. And I don't really understand, like, what is Tronc's, what's their end game?
This is, I think I saw somebody tweet, when you have this stable of publications that you have and you decide instead of using all of the iconic names of these papers to call your thing Tronc. Maybe that's evidence that your strategic thinking is flawed. But yeah, I mean, I do think, you know, there's a certain line of argumentation here that says, like, this is a management problem, or this is a problem with attempting to extract profits. And it seems like the problem is deeper than that. The problem is, like, who is subscribing? Who is advertising? How do we pay for Nancy Rommelman to hang out in a cop bar for 6 months? And the answer is, we just can't
anymore. We don't do it anymore. I go off and I write books, right? But, you know, then we get into, like, well, it's what people want. Like, if people want to buy newspapers, they're going to buy newspapers. But if they don't want to buy newspapers, the newspapers are going to die, right?
The gale of creative destruction will sweep through the industry.
Yeah.
You wrote for Reason a while back about teen sexters, which is another great category of people making decisions where you maybe want to shout, like, don't do it. You're going to suffer. But again, the sort of deterministic question of, like, well, okay, you know, thousands of teens do
don't
exactly
do
this.
It. I mean, okay, these kids, you know, you're walking around with a hard on 5 hours a day. They're going to sext each other. They're going to send each other pictures. It's going to happen. And if we think it's not going to happen, what we have to do is not be hysterical about it, because this is what kids are going to do. They're going to do it. And I think that was sort of, you know, the premise of the piece. It's like, the problem here is not that she sent him a picture of her tits. The problem is that her father lost his mind and went to the sheriff, and then this kid's going to be, I mean, it actually turned out okay, but who created the problem here? The tit pick is not the problem.
That's your motto from
that's
now
it.
On.
I haven't getting it tattooed.
The,
right
the Nancy Rollman
right.
story, colon, the tit pick is not the problem. So this is, you know, I think many of these stories, because they kind of live on like an extreme end of human behavior or reactions to human behavior, they ultimately involve law enforcement. And I, you know, your cop bar reminds me of this as well. Talk about, I guess, first of all, maybe talk a little bit about your politics. I mean, we don't always necessarily need to be like planting the libertarian flag every time on this podcast, but I do think, particularly into The Bridge, there's this little kind of vignette in there about the police boat. So maybe you can tell that story and then just tell more broadly, you know, where do your politics sit in relation to law enforcement and the role it plays in your stories?
Well, I'm going to actually just flop that and say, so I reviewed Radley Balko's last book, The Something in the Country Dentist. If you want to get enraged at law enforcement and the judiciary and the prejudice and the laziness and the hatefulness, or if you're following Pamela Koloff and her incredible pieces that she's done, and actually they're actually throwing out the forensic junk science that put that guy, I can't remember his name, in jail. I am constantly amazed, and you guys at Reason do an amazing job with this, at how bad law enforcement is at their job. I mean, I'm not saying cops don't do good things too. They do. But it's just the putting away of the wrong people or putting them away for stupid reasons is just, it boggles the mind. Okay, so the police boat, Eldon and Trinity go off the bridge. About 3 months later, there's a city commissioner, and he says before the other councilman or city councilman, the other four members, he's like, when I heard that tape, that 911 tape of that little girl shouting, "Don't, mommy, don't," I knew that we had to find money for that police boat. It's actually a fire boat to get there faster and maybe have saved her brother. Well, there is no tape of Trinity or any child screaming, "Don't, mommy, don't," because the first time there's any 911 recordings are when she's in the water. But that didn't matter because he got his money for the police boat. And then they staged this whole incredible ceremony where, you know, they've got the people from the city council and then blah, 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 and the families, and they stand Trinity on a box so that she can talk into the mic and, you know, thank everybody that's there. And it was a debacle. I mean, everybody felt really super great about themselves. You know, oh, look, we've done this great thing. And I have no problem with there being another rescue boat named after these kids. But it was dissembling. And it was politics. And as I put in the book, like, what has more energy than the murder of a child, right? It can jump hosts and become a police boat. So that's what it did.
The idea of never waste a crisis relevant here.
Right.
This is something that was on the to-do list, and this.
Right. And she fit the bill. Yeah. And if it, you know, and I actually interviewed him right before I was not going to press, but, you know, getting the book done to just see if he could clarify this a little. And he just said, oh, well, you know, it had been very hard to hear. So
on the tape.
Yeah. Very hard to hear. Yeah.
That definitely was from like.
Yeah. That was not
minutes
at all.
And minutes after.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, this is another thing that, you know, to kind of come back to the beginning of the discussion, like, people want to tell a story about, you know, anything that happens that seems unusual or outside of the norm. And the story can be evil or the story can be crazy. But the story also has to be one of redemption. Lots of people like, you know, and in the end, all the children who fell in the river that day forth were saved by the boat.
It sounds like the Bible.
You know. Is there always a story of redemption to be had? You know, as a writer, there's always a temptation for the end of your story to be, and then all the children were saved by the new police boat. And I think many, many, many journalists give in to that temptation.
I don't know why they do that.
What helps you resist that temptation?
I have no desire to do that. I have no desire to tie it up with a little bow for you. I want you to tell the story as it happens. Are there redeeming moments in this book? I think there are. I mean, one, again, being Trinity, you know, they took her out onto the river on that police boat thing, and they drove her out. It was a shit day. It was freezing. It was raining. She's on this boat, and they made her wait in the rain for an hour till the press boat got there to get their pictures, which is just insanity. But I was told later by someone else on the boat when they pointed out to Trinity where she was found. She's like, where? And she was curious. And that, I thought, was, I hate to say that this was positive, but, you know, I'm sure she's got a million people telling her she should be damaged and traumatized. And she is, I'm sure she will be in certain ways. But she also still was curious. And I thought that was somewhat hopeful that she could have that. There's a redeeming moment. We meet Amanda's older child and, you know, what he's able to tell us and what he was able to come through and how. I thought that was very redemptive. In terms of the grown-ups in this book, not so much.
Yeah. I think that not so much about wrapped it up.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about the process of getting this book published. So your publisher is Little A, which is an Amazon imprint. And that means that the publication of the book and the process of editing and fact-checking were maybe a little bit different than the traditional industry. Can you describe that?
So I will tell you how it happened. I wrote the whole book before. I didn't even have an agent at the time anymore. I didn't have a publisher. I just wrote the book. Found an agent pretty quickly. I told him I really wanted to publish with Amazon because my best girlfriend had published with them for 6 years, and it was pretty much of a utopian experience when a lot of other authors were just, it was just going to the shits because there's no money, the old ways don't work, don't do book tours, all this stuff. Okay. So as it turns out, the editor I wanted, who had edited a great book called Lost Girls by Bob Kolker when he was at Harper, had gone to Amazon to head up Little A to bring some good journalistic nonfiction in, and so he bought the book. He was brilliant and funny and got it and told me the right things to do. They had an incredible fact-checking process, which is also something that they're not doing in a lot of books these days because there's just no money. Amazon has some money. They did an incredible design on the book. And, you know, we published the book. The downsides are Amazon's the enemy, right? To traditional bookstores, to a lot of the traditional media. My agent's sort of perturbed that I can't get reviewed, which is a little weird because even in the places that I review for, but you know what? You make your trade. I will say that, so Powell's Books is in Portland, and I live in Portland, Oregon most of the time, and I've read at Powell's 4 times before. I've been on stage interviewing authors. They wouldn't give me a reading. They just wouldn't do it because they will not give Amazon authors a reading. And I have a friend who works there, and he wrote to the CEO. He's like, it's Nancy, and it's a Portland story. They would not budge. It's like, you know what? We throw our own party. I don't care. But it just shows you that it's like you'll make your trade. I'm delighted to be with Amazon. They're open 24/7 around the world. And I loved working with them, and I will work with them again. But, you know, there are some trades.
It's a weird world when Powell's Books and Donald Trump are on the same side of an alliance, like, and Nancy Rommelman is on the other.
Over here. But here's the thing. It's like, okay, guys, I get it. I get that there was disruption. But you know what? You know why Amazon's successful? Because people like it, okay? They like shopping on Amazon, right? And they like getting it for a better price. So deal with it.
Talk a little bit about what the reception of the book has been like. I mean, I think, you know, the temptation to look for ghoulishness in an author who writes about something so dark is probably significant. And I went actually and looked at some of the Amazon reviews, which I know some authors, for the sake of their own sanity,
that's
do not
important.
Do.
You're like, okay, that's, I'm done.
But I felt like there was maybe a little more than usual in the sort of speculation about why this book came into being that I saw in there. You know, how has the book been received, and how do you think the existence of this book reflects on you?
For the most part, people that are actually reading the book, it's being super well received. There's a coterie of people that feel that if you are writing about the murder of a child and not giving every penny that you make to a, you know, a women's shelter or a children's organization, you are writing in children's blood. I've gotten several pieces of hate mail saying, you know, you're a bottom feeder, you're a parasite, and nothing is true in this book. You know, as I've said before, if you have some provocative complaints, I would love to hear them and talk to you. Being told that I'm a bottom feeder is nothing new. I think people are receiving it well. It's not a ghoulish book at all. And it's not a sensational book at all. It's a narrative book that you're going to come on this story and maybe understand something that you did not think was understandable. And I just don't see how that's a bad thing ever.
Why do you think it's so different when you're writing this story in book form versus as a journalist? Because I think, of course, people do sometimes accuse journalists of being ghoulish bottom feeders, sometimes rightly. Mm-hmm. But the sense of, if you put these words about a dead child on newsprint, you're a public servant. And if you put these words about dead child between two hardcovers, you're a profit-seeking monster. Why?
Maybe because you throw the paper out the next day and you don't have to think about it. I don't know. But also, the way these stories are reported in the paper, it's very superficial. And it's not their fault. They've got another story they have to write the next day. I had time to sort of, you know, the luxury of time to spread out. I think it's a subject that we often really don't want to know a lot more about. So, okay, we read it in the paper. I've made my decision and now bye. That's all. So it's kind of a non-story.
Yeah, I think there's probably something to the ephemerality of the press coverage that makes people more forgiving of it. I think that's right. Now, as threatened, what are you working on? What's new?
Well, I'm going to reveal something here for the first time. So, I mean, I'm doing some articles. I think I'm doing one, looking into one for you. But in the book, Amanda Stott Smith had four children altogether. She had her older son in 1997. She had a child in 1999 that she gave up for adoption. And then she had the two younger children that she threw from the bridge. I had done the audio recording from the book in Michigan, and I was coming through the DC airport, and, you know, you can't get any sort of reception on your phone, but I saw I had something on my phone that said, I need to speak to you about your upcoming book, To the Bridge, which is like not exactly what an author wants to hear 10 weeks out. It's like, oh crap. Like what? I got something. They got an advanced copy. There's something majorly wrong and I'm fucked. But no, it was that child she gave up for adoption.
Wow.
Who had found out in 2016 from her adoptive mother who her birth mother was. And she sort of didn't believe her mother and kind of was like looking around, and she'd had an interesting life. And then she found out about the book and she emailed me and said, I would love to talk to you because I would love to know more about my family. And so I went and spent 5 days with her in Phoenix. So that's what I'm writing right now.
Wow. Who are you writing that for?
I don't know yet.
Maybe Reason.
I would love to write it for Reason.
So, I mean, obviously I won't ask you to give away more, but that does raise one question that comes up in To the Bridge as well, which is, you know, what does it mean for these kids to, you know, have this in their blood, right? And this, of course, is the eternal nature-nurture question and so many other things, but...
Okay, so what is the fundamental adoptee's question? It's probably like, who is my mother? Am I like my mother? Okay, so what is this? What is she thinking? Like, she's reaching out to me. Am I like my mother? One question. Second question, and I'm not saying she said that, but that's what you would think.
This is the classic.
The second question would be like, well, if I'd been in that car, would I have been thrown off the bridge? There's also some other interesting things, like her mother, who had adopted her, started, you know, treating her maybe not so great when she found out about this. Like, maybe we've got a demon seed in the house. So it was but having said all that, I'm making it sound very heavy and I'm not going to give anything away except to say it was not what you would expect and in a delightful way. So, I just pitched the story.
You guys, this was live action journalism on the Reason podcast, the writer-editor conversation in action. I mean, I think this is something that the question by adoptees or by people who, you know, have a, you know, donor gametes involved in their creation, that there's a weird way in which all of the cover questions can now be answered without contact, right? Like, mm-hmm. It used to be like, oh, I want to know my health history. Right. And it's like, well, just get 23.
Right. Right.
Like, oh, I want to know, you know, my ethnic composition. Yeah. Ancestry.com would be happy to
answer
that question.
Or Facebook. I mean, you can find your half-brother, you know, if you want to.
You know, on last week's Monday podcast, I actually recommended another podcast called Family Ghosts, which is it's a series of podcasts where people dig into a sort of half-known, semi-secret truth that's lurking in their families. And you, it's a bit of a recurring motif of like, well, I just wanted to know the truth about myself. But I think you've kind of hit on it when it's like, well, what are you really asking? Because you're not really asking, is there a history of heart disease in my family? Mm-hmm. When you go looking for the answer to that question, you're asking, am I a murderer in my heart? You're asking something blurrier and more existential, I think. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
For talking with me about your book, talking with me about your career, and pitching me a story live on the Reason Podcast. This has been Nancy Rommelman, author of the new book, To the Bridge, and Catherine Mangy Ward, editor-in-chief of Reason, for the Reason Podcast. If you like what you heard today, you should go over to iTunes, subscribe, rate and review us, do whatever you like over there, as long as it's nice. Thank you for listening.